You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, is there anything worth reforming in the U.S. criminal justice system? New York City cops want to deploy machine guns and felony charges against political protesters. And the campaign continues to establish a real party for socialism in South Africa.
But first, a new study by the Sentencing Project in Washington has identified a list of programs across the country that could be useful in lessening racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Nash Gol Ganush is author of the report titled Black Lives Matter, Eliminating Racial Inequity in the Criminal Justice System.
These were programs that we were familiar with, and we especially wanted to identify ones that had some kind of measured impact. Some were too new, and so there's not yet an analysis of how effective they are, but we wanted to profile them because they seemed really well-suited to address one of the causes of racial disparity that we outlined in the report.
The title is Black Lives Matter, Eliminating Racial Inequity in the Criminal Justice System. How would this compendium be of use to the movement that lots of people call the Black Lives Matter movement?
What we wanted to do was to help broaden the discussion about what the problem was. So what I was seeing a lot of was people getting into the details of what happened between Officer Darren Wilson and Michael Brown, between Officer Daniel Pantaleo and Eric Garner. These details are important for understanding those specific cases. But it's also important to not think that this is an issue of a couple of police officers and their failure to follow rules of conduct or even problems of rules of conduct and policing. The broader issue is the excessive levels of contact that people of color have with the criminal justice system. So if you think about what caused the initial interaction between these men, these unarmed men who were killed by police officers, why were they even in contact with the officers? There are really trivial reasons. Michael Brown was jaywalking, and it was an escalation of that interaction, the police stopping him for that, that led to his death. Eric Garner was selling untaxed loose cigarettes, and it's because the officer was carrying out broken windows policing policy and trying to arrest him for that activity. It was an escalation of that interaction that led to his death. And so if we think more broadly about what the problem is, which is high levels of contact that people of color have with the justice system, it doesn't stop at policing. It continues. The excessive contact and excessive punishment happens at all stages. It continues when you look at prosecutors and their policies and their use of discretion. It happens at bail decisions, in determinations about who has to pay money bond in order to be released pretrial, in the sentencing decisions that judges are able to make, and so on. And so because the problem is so broad and because the causes of the problem really apply at all of these different stages, we thought it would be useful to look at all of this together to identify the sources of the problem and identify the best practices available to address them.
Yes. Some of us at Black Agenda Report say that Michael Brown and Eric Garner and the rest were killed by the mass black incarceration regime.
Well, certainly they're factors that lead to mass incarceration, which is excessive contact at the level of policing that you see in these cases. And it's also true that while we mourn their deaths and we think about these tragic outcomes, a lot of other people who have similar contact with the justice system don't suffer from the same extremely tragic fate But what they do end up suffering from is the stigma of having a criminal record, the trauma of having to go through the system. And so while we don't feel that tragedy as acutely, that happens to a lot more people and influences a lot more people. And so that's all the more reason to think about what to do about these underlying causes of these problems.
Yes, and in fact, some of the schemes that police describe as community policing actually increase the frequency of police contact with civilians on the street.
You know, community policing, it's a broad term that can be used to describe many different things. Even when it comes to understanding broken windows policing, broken windows is also a really broad term, and so it depends on how it's being defined. So, for example, some studies, you know, the research on broken windows policing shows that at best it has a modest impact on serious crime rates. So that's the whole theory of broken windows policing, that if you go after the broken windows, or which is to say the small, lower-level petty offenses, then you can get at the bigger problems. You can catch people early on before they go on to commit more serious offenses. Unfortunately, the research doesn't support this, or at best it shows a modest relationship between order maintenance policing and serious crimes. But some studies, for example, show that there is a strong relationship. But if you look closely, you'll see that when they say broken windows policing, they're not talking about the kinds of arrests that Eric Gardner had experienced and was about to experience. They're talking about police officers going in to fix broken windows, to fix hallway lights in public housing, or to help to improve the neighborhood conditions in a way that helped to reduce serious crimes. Now, that sounds like good policy, right? That sounds like something that we would like to see, but that's not what people are generally thinking about when they speak critically about broken windows policing. What people more often are thinking about when they're critical of it is these arrests for minor petty offenses. And we see that the outcome of that is excessive contact, sometimes fatal, but also negative consequences for a much broader population.
You've drawn these various programs that you've included in the compendium from about 20 states. I see that the top one with a bullet refers to Indiana, where a drug-free zone...
Drug-free school zone. They modified their drug-free school zone sentencing laws. A lot of folks are familiar with the crack cocaine sentencing disparity. And what that was about was that people would and are continuing to get longer sentences for the same amount of crack as for cocaine, because a smaller amount of crack would trigger a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years than for cocaine. Now, that's a popular one. Another law that disproportionately affects people of color, and that happens throughout the country, these laws exist, are drug-free school zones. So what these laws do is they're trying to keep kids away from drugs. Sounds like a great idea. But what they do is they enhance penalties. If someone is caught selling drugs, sometimes the rule is about 1,000 feet within a school. Now, if you live in an affluent area and you're selling drugs, and let's say you sell it in your car to somebody, chances are you have a pretty good chance of staying away from a school. If you live in an urban area, and studies have mapped out school zones and how this law affects sentencing, and they've shown that there's very few parts of the city that you could actually be sitting in a car, let's say, and selling drugs where you would not find yourself in a school zone. So a similar law ends up having a very different impact in two different areas, in a suburban expansive area versus in a very dense urban area. Now, what do we know about the demographics of who lives in the two areas? More often, you have white people, wealthier, living in suburban areas, and you have low-income people of color living in urban areas. And so this is a disparate impact of this policy. And so as a result of recognizing this impact, some jurisdictions and some states, including Indiana, have modified their law to reduce the parameter around schools that they consider a school zone where sentencing is enhanced for selling drugs, and some other changes as well in order to limit the disparate impact of that policy.
And yet I do remember no more than 2 years ago in Indianapolis, even the U.S. attorney joined in with local officials in pledging stricter enforcement of gun violations in what he described as high crime designated neighborhoods. And those neighborhoods turned out to be almost entirely black neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have consistency across the board on different policies, unfortunately. What we've tried to do here is to shift the conversation to first assess what the problem is, but then to try to identify remedies that are being implemented to address those problems. And that doesn't mean that those jurisdictions have got it all right, but it does mean that on that issue, they're doing something right and they serve as models for other parts of the country. And so it sounds like Indianapolis and Indiana are not models necessarily for these other policies that you're describing.
And how are you interacting with people who are members of that broadly designated Black Lives Matter movement?
I think what we've done is, for example, through social media, I've tracked what's been going on with people that are tweeting, for example, on issues related to this, and that's helped me stay on top of what's going on. That's helped me to stay on top of tension within the movement about who is rightly representing the movement and who is not. And so that all has shaped my thinking in the process of writing this report. And we're hoping that this report will kind of feed back to people that are interested in this movement to think more broadly beyond policing and to think about what the solutions are out there so that we don't just kind of shrug and say, well, you know, the system is racist. What can you do? What else would you expect? But instead, actually think more concretely about what specific steps need to be taken and have been taken to address these problems.
That was Nash Gol Ganush of the Sentencing Project in Washington.
Blacks and civil liberties advocates were shocked at New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton's plans to establish a new machine gun toting police unit to deal with both terrorist attacks and peaceful Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Bratton also endorsed raising the punishment for resisting arrest from a misdemeanor to a felony. Josmar Trujillo is an activist with New Yorkers Against Bratton.
The amazing thing about what Bratton and de Blasio have been able to do amidst all of these announcements is that they're still somehow telling people, and people believe, that they're progressives or that they're instituting something that's considerably more friendly to the community than what Bloomberg and Kelly did. And it just boggles the mind because I think people are no longer going to see this just simply as hyperbole. This is a police state. This is fascism in a sense that people are seeing the police have such outsized power and control over the political landscape and over our lives with the weaponry they're going to have, that there's almost going to be, at a certain point, no ability to even fight back against this. And Commissioner Bratton's announcement about the strategic response team, although his number one chief, Chief O'Neill, did try to walk it back a little bit a few days later, you know, it was so bold in that it was basically a public threat to protesters. For the tens of thousands of protesters that were out there marching and saying controversial things like Black Lives Matter, that the response to that is machine guns and that he said it is incredible. And Bratton wouldn't have said that if that's not what was going to happen. You know, I think the backlash caught up with him, but it's just amazing what these two have been able to do in New York City. And the amount of resources that this mayor and that this city council is going to give to the NYPD is just going to make the NYPD stronger and stronger at a time when they should be, in fact, actually being scrutinized and defunded and all those things because they're killing us with impunity. It's just almost beyond words.
In terms of the proposal that resisting arrest be a felony, every person who has grown up in a barrio or a hood knows that if the police hit you, you are guaranteed to be charged with resisting arrest, and now it would be a felony.
Absolutely. One of the first reactions that I got from a public defender that emailed me, she was like, every time I see a resisting arrest with any of my clients, I know it's because the cops brutalized that person. And sometimes it's just a way, or oftentimes, or maybe all the time, it's just a way of covering up that brutality. So the fact that it's going to be up to a felony is just so dangerous. It's going to make so many people think twice about any kind of this peaceful marching because we know what the police are capable of doing and how they're able to kind of just throw on charges onto almost anybody that they see fit. It's, again, it's just another way of threatening protesters, threatening even the chance of there being some kind of broad mass movement in the streets for any length of time. It's incredible. And another thing that somebody pointed out to me just this morning was the ability of the cops to essentially, with the resisting arrest, also make justified deadly force in almost any time that they interact with you, he described it as kind of like a checkmate to any brutality claims as well. So if you get beaten up by the cops, you're going to have a felony on you. It's going to be a lot harder to go through with some of these lawsuits and some of these cases against the city and against NYPD. And there's only so many strategies one can take against NYPD, and they're basically making sure that they kind of shrink all of those options for us. It's just incredible.
So here we have pressures being brought against the NYPD to back off of its broken windows philosophy. And instead, we see Commissioner Bratton and the mayor, de Blasio, seeming to double down on police repression with this 350-man machine gun-toting force and with threats to up the penalties for alleged resisting arrest and other such measures.
You know, the amazing thing also about the 350 machine gun toting NYPD thugs, I call them, that are going to be under Bratton's control, is that he also made that announcement as he was also talking about community policing and talking about bringing the community and NYPD together. So I think the one thing that's also going to come from all this is they're kind of walking away from the broken windows language. They'll defend it, but they also understand that people are now starting to look into it and look, you know, like get a clear idea of what this actually entails and how ridiculous it is. And so they're going to actually try to replace that in terms of the narrative through the media and in their own rhetoric with this community policing language, which is just a bunch of BS. And they're going to be able to win, I think, some people over and get some people's guards down, because community policing sounds a lot better than broken windows, because it leads to broken lives and broken backs and broken necks and all these things. So they're going to be very strategic about how they talk about these things. But the irony of talking about bringing people together in one sentence and then talking about machine guns as if the NYPD isn't armed to the teeth enough in the same sentence, in the same breath, right afterwards, it's just a testament to how arrogant and how audacious these leaders are.
And one of the lessons is that community policing seems to mean whatever the police want it to mean.
Exactly. There was a survey of police chiefs and leaders of departments around the country that talked about community policing, and I think something like 90% of them said that they institute some form of community policing, because I think they all recognize that this was kind of just a catch-all phrase that could pretty much mean whatever they wanted it to mean. And so it means almost nothing. It means whatever the cops want it to mean. It could mean broken windows, which it's commonly associated with. It could mean gang injunctions. It could mean the NYPD just getting closer with people for the purposes of surveillance, or trying to get people in their community to snitch on other people in their community. And people who've been around politics enough know that that term goes back for decades. And for all these decades, it hasn't meant a better relationship between us and cops. It's just meant a continuation, but with the ability for the cops to come out politically with the rhetoric of something that sounds nice and people can kind of take home and feel better about community policing. It's the opposite of what we want. And we, Neighbors Against Bratton and the groups that we're working with, Odito Sunset Park, Queens Neighborhoods United, all of these grassroots groups, we recognize that New York is going to be the first place that they're going to be really kind of focusing on changing that narrative, because New York is probably the biggest platform for policing in America. And we have to make sure that community and policing are actually separate. And we want to make sure that people understand that. We're not trying to bring the cops and us closer together. The cops have abused and brutalized us and killed us for longer than I can probably articulate. And the lesson is to draw clear lines between us and them, and to make sure that we have a completely new strategy that doesn't involve us bringing guys with machine guns into our communities and closer to our hearts. It means like really drawing lines and starting to actually create areas of liberation and self-determination where the cops don't have to be involved in every aspect of our lives. They don't have to be in all our after-school programs. They don't have to be in our churches. They don't have to be spying on us and our social media and everything. They need to actually get out of our communities.
And yet the Reverend Al Sharpton, who's headquartered in New York, welcomed with open arms Police Commissioner Bratton and his return to leadership of the NYPD. And yet he claims to be part of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, Barr and a lot of other people have for years very clearly and convincingly explain to people what Al Sharpton's role is, I think, in the civil rights movement or the Civil Rights Inc. movement. And I think that, you know, that facade of, of Sharpton kind of being the voice of people. I think it's just a matter of time before people start to realize that he has very small support in terms of the protesters that are out there marching and really pushing for justice, not just here in New York, but across the country. In Ferguson, he was basically kicked out, from what I remember. And he welcomed back Brad in the beginning of this year. And I think it was pretty obvious for people in the know who said, like, this is just about politics. This is just about his access to power. This is about him being a talking head on MSNBC and having Obama and Mayor de Blasio on speed dial and being able to have that access. And it's just so painfully clear now that Al Sharpton is no longer the voice, but it should be clear also that he's not just not speaking truth to power, but he's actually working against our interests, working to, as Barr has articulated for years, to be a gatekeeper and keep us from really being able to push ahead and do new things. And he wants to herd people back and under his banner. And I don't think anybody wants to go under his banner anymore.
And you, Brother Trujillo, have brought to our attention the fact that of these new police bulletproof vests that the city is purchasing for millions of dollars are embossed with a Crusader cross and such symbolism.
Right. So this just came down the news feed where the mayor and city council speaker were all proudly announcing that they were going to invest almost $8 million towards bulletproof vests for cops. And one of the pictures that I saw from there is one of the breastplates inside the vest has a crusader-like cross. I think it's called a paraclete over the heart. And this is just people who followed what the U.S. military troops have done with their machine guns, putting quotes from the Bible on their guns and acting like modern-day crusaders, or in fact, maybe even being modern-day crusaders. This is the war coming home, and this is just should be obvious to anyone who's paying attention what the NYPD means. It's the domestic arm of this kind of militarism that goes around and kills brown and black bodies all over this earth, and that is doing so also to the descendants that live within its borders. It's incredible.
Josmar Trujillo of New Yorkers Against Bratton.
It is now fashionable in some circles to claim to support prison reform. But how is it possible to reform the world's biggest, most draconian, and arguably most racist system of incarceration? Kenneth Hartman is executive director of the Other Death Penalty Project. He filed this report for Prison Radio.
America's got a prison problem, a big prison problem that isn't going to be fixed by a few timid reforms around the edges. Even after the slight declines of the past few years, this country's incarceration rate remains far and away the highest in the world, higher than any country in the history of the world, in fact. And the money being spent on prisons is positively obscene. Money that's being poured down a drain, wasted and denied to the pressing problems of a country with thousands of crumbling schools, too few hospital beds for poor children, and a social safety net full of gaping holes. Of course, the true cost of prisons is a veritable state secret, but it's certainly well north of $100 billion a year. For that amount of money, the people have purchased 10 million children who have been forced to deal with parental imprisonment, many millions of their fellow citizens, mostly people of color, almost exclusively the poor, permanently deprived of their voting rights, and a hidden system of punitive institutions scattered across all 50 states, with a total population that would make it the fourth largest city in the country, bigger than the populations of 15 of the states. The federal government admits to almost 7 million people under some form of criminal justice control, the second biggest city, the 13th largest state. Decades ago, Angela Davis coined the term prison industrial complex to describe what was then the nascent rise of the carceral state in this country. As late as the 1990s, when I was writing opinion pieces for California newspapers, editors refused to publish that term, seeing it as lefty propaganda, as radical ramblings, as paranoid. Today, the mainstream media often uses prison industrial complex, a triumph for honesty, yes, but also a sad testament to the growth of prisons. No one without their own axe to grind denies the explosion in prisons these days. The real issue is what to do about this problem. For many well-meaning reformers, a strategy of nibbling away at the edges has been embraced. Here in California, bills have been proposed that aim to deinstitutionalize women, juveniles, nonviolent offenders, drug users, and the elderly. While the rest of us don't begrudge anyone slipping out of the shackles of imprisonment, this approach raises a troubling question. What about the rest of prisoners, the ones who don't fit into one of these deserving groups? Most of us aren't in one of these deserving categories. Should we, therefore, be subjected to cruel and inhumane treatment? Is it then reasonable to sentence us to terms of imprisonment that stretch out beyond the horizon of our lifetimes? Are we somehow irredeemable, not worth the effort at restoration and rehabilitation? Like it or not, that is the implicit message of this approach to criminal justice reform. And nowhere is this unreasonable and unfair message pushed more than in the death penalty abolitionist movement. Here in California, a recent failed proposition would have abolished the death penalty and replaced it with life without the possibility of parole. Deeper still, it offered to the voters an explicit promise that no one serving life without the possibility of parole would ever, ever get out. On their websites, these civil rights groups trumpeted how serving forever in prison was, actually, a worse form of suffering than a lethal injection. Bottom line, they were willing to assure the death in prison of close to 4,000 men and women in trade for ending what they don't like based on the outright statement that we deserve to die in prison because we aren't deserving of being treated as fellow human beings. Those of us who have struggled from inside Mother California's concrete and steel empire surely didn't expect to get shanked in the back from our left flank. In the upcoming couple of years before the next elections, all of us who are committed to fundamental reform of this failed system of injustice need to sit down and do some serious soul searching. Is the goal of reform to bring home all prisoners, or is it to only bring home a few? Is the goal of reform to end mass incarceration, or is it to just shrink the prison state down a little? Is it wrong to torment, torture, and traumatize all human beings, or just a few deserving humans? The actions of the broad community of reformers will answer these questions. Remember, while you're thinking about all of this, that our peer nations, other industrialized democracies, have been able to create societies just as safe and stable, more so in most cases, without imprisoning so many of their citizens. As former United States Senator Jim Webb observed, either we're a particularly evil people, or there's something wrong with our criminal justice system. We are not a particularly evil people. The criminal justice system, the prison industrial complex, well, that's a different matter altogether.
That was Kenneth Hartman of the Other Death Penalty Project.
A memorial service was held in Philadelphia last weekend for Phil Africa, an imprisoned member of the MOVE family who died last month under suspicious circumstances. He was held incommunicado for 6 days before succumbing to a mysterious illness. Phil Africa was serving a 30 to 100-year sentence at the state prison in Dallas, Pennsylvania, in the 1978 shooting death of a policeman. 7 years later, in 1985, the police bombed the MOVE family home in Philadelphia, killing 11 people, including women and children, and burning down the whole city block. Activist Pam Africa spoke at the memorial for Phil Africa.
Phil's life is an example of resistance, of true resistance. And you not only find that in Phil, but you find that in every last MOVE member that there is. The resistance, I'm saying committed MOVE members, you find that. But everybody's talking about the greatness of Phil, and we can talk for hours and never even hit the tip of the iceberg on it. I want to talk about when I met MOVE and Phil, I thought that I was coming to help MOVE. When I saw the confrontation in 1977 and the police had surrounded MOVE, I really thought that I was out there for me to help them. But through these years, it's been MOVE helping me, and I want everybody else to understand the battle that the MOVE organization is doing, is waging against this government, is for each and every last one of us. Inside the prison, outside and old Wayne, for years, all you hear people speak about is life, about mama, about the air, the water, the soil, and all. That is so important. The fight for these things, the necessities of life, is something that we all must get involved in. I remember one time when our sisters was fighting about water in the prison, and another former political prisoner said, y'all talking about water, I'm talking about freeing political prisoners. But if you can't make the connection between water and political prisoners, prisoners and the prisoners on the outside, you're not making a connection at all. And because you need water to survive. Fracking. My brother Phil died in that prison because he wasn't supposed to be there. He was healthy and strong when he went in. And they write letters about the people that are now dying in the prisons on a daily basis. They talk about how, the ambulance is like one right after another because they can only keep a body in the prison for 4 hours. But they're constantly coming. And, when we say, hands up, don't shoot, and Black Lives Matter, all lives matter. When are we going to concentrate on what's happening inside those prisons? And the death camps that's inside the prisons. Move people when they went to jail. That was an activity. And each and every life, every move person take that activity very serious. The same information and love and understanding that people get on the street is what you get from every last move person that's in prison. We can't tell you enough, what it means to fight for your air, your water, and your soul. That is revolution. That is, protecting yourself. This government didn't come after move and all because move cursed. And MOVE demonstrated against puppy pals and things like that. They came after MOVE, because MOVE is waking people up about all life. And the animal rights movement now, I learned about animal rights in 1977 with MOVE. The MOVE was battling toe-to-toe about animals that's in the prison. And people who as a place to go and, take your family and think that the animals is doing fine. Those are concentration camps, death camps, just like the ones that people recognize that people are inside those prisons. And when I first encountered the MOVE, they were demonstrating a puppy palace. And I'm like, what? And, this is where the cute little birds are in the cages. And when the animals are in the windows, but what you was looking at was a death trap, prisons. And it's MOVE who make you understand the necessity of life. And if you're talking about freeing political prisoners, all prisons, you got to take it all the way across the board, or no one's going to be free. That's what God in Africa taught. The water that is pent up and dammed is imprisoned. And the same monster, the same government, the same people that is doing it all the way across the board. The resistance that MOVE had, I just really want people to understand what this fight is about. May 13th, we're asking you to come. You want to do something for Phil? Do what Phil has done and what Merle has done. And another one of our sisters in the prison, who passed, was murdered by this government. Stand up, continue to resist, continue to fight. We won't shut this mother down.
The demonstration begins at noon on May 13th to mark the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the MOVE family by police under the direction of Black Philadelphia Mayor Wilson Good.
The U.S.-backed president of Haiti, Michelle Sweetmickey Martelly, is promising to hold elections by the end of this year. The question is, will they be fair and free elections? We spoke with Kim Ives of the newspaper Haiti Liberté.
Well, that's the $64,000 question. As Senator Moise Jean-Charles said once, he can't hold even an honest carnival, much less an election. This is because in the carnival, which is supposed to be organized independently, like the elections, he intervened to say that certain very critical musical groups could not take part in the carnival. So it is the feeling of many in the opposition and in the population that Martelly cannot be trusted to hold a fair and free election. And it certainly can't be a sovereign election because his protectors, the UN mission to stabilize Haiti, so-called, or MINUSTA, would also be overseeing those elections. And they intervened in the election that got him elected, overruling the Provisional Electoral Council, essentially shoehorning him into the presidency. And so that is why most of the opposition is calling for Martelly to step down and Minister to leave before elections can be held.
And what has Martelly's stance been on that demand?
Well, his response has been to form this new government, which is headed by one of Haiti's most archetypal opportunists, Evans Paul, alias Caplume or Compeplume, who has distinguished himself over the past three decades to be a completely unscrupulous politician, and as in a way is testified by the fact that he chose to accept the post of prime minister under Martelly in the face of the nationwide uprising against Martelly. And he reshuffled the Electoral Council, putting together a council more or less along the lines that the opposition had been demanding. But again, it was his hand-picked people, and there was no consultation done with the opposition for it. So essentially, it's a stillborn Electoral Council, and the elections are not likely to get far. That said, it is possible that he will make assurances and possibly bribes to elements of the opposition in an attempt to win them over into the election and see it go forward. So right now we could say it is on the rim, but the people in the streets are continuing their mobilization. And I think it's more than likely that with the repression the government is giving them in the forms of tear gas, rubber bullets, water cannon, every time they take to the streets, there will be more deaths, more injuries, and hence more demonstrations.
We, of course, in the United States don't get a lot of coverage of what's happening on the streets in Haiti. Could you describe the intensity of the opposition?
Well, it's an extremely passionate mobilization. The people have really demonstrated their resolve by going out not just weekly, but sometimes almost daily. And these are demonstrations of thousands of people. I was there 2 weeks ago and watched really these rivers. I mean, that's how the notion of lavalas or flood first was coined. These rivers of humanity coming down the narrow streets of Bel Air, Fort Nacional, Delma, and pouring out into the central square in front of where the palace was. And the anger, and I would say the determination, is palpable. You can see the people are determined to see Martelly go. I mean, the Haitian people can absorb a lot of abuse, as the 30 years of Duvalier dictatorship testify to. But when they are done with you, they are done with you. And it is very hard to put that genie back in the bottle. And I think that's the situation we have on the streets of Haiti today.
What are the prospects for the family Lavalas taking part in these proposed elections?
Well, I think in my mind, this is really where the U.S. Embassy is going to be putting their emphasis and, I think, attention. Even though they've twice backed coup d'etats against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Aristide has always wanted to be in the empire's good graces and has recently made a statement through his phenomenal head of the party, Dr. Maurice Narcisse, that they are the moderate opposition. They never called for Martelly's resignation previously. They were just calling for Lamotte's resignation and the freeing of political prisoners and changing the Electoral Council, which is essentially what Martelly gave. But they have always been, I could say, the most cautious of the opposition. And so I think knowing this, and I think people in the State Department are probably debating this as we speak, they may, to save the situation and to make an election that will have any credibility, they have to get somebody like Fahmy Lavalas on board. So they may make a deal. And from what we've been told while I was in Haiti, there is a train of representatives of the European and North American embassies, U.S., French, Canadian, Spanish, etc., constantly passing through Tabar, that is former President Aristide's home, making their case. Up until now, as far as we know, no deal has been struck. But I think that this will be the big question. Will Fahmy Lavalas agree to go into an election with Martelly? And even if they go with Martelly, will they do it with Minusta in place? This is a very open question.
Yes, with Minusta in place, there are clearly issues of sovereignty involved here.
Yes, and that is what, for instance, the Dessalinian current of the opposition insists on. They say that both Martelly and Minusta have to go. And we can say that Haiti's last truly free, fair, and sovereign election was in 1990 when President Aristide was elected. At that time, Jimmy Carter, who was an electoral observer, in fact, had gone to Aristide and had proposed that he give the election to Marc Bazin, his neoliberal former World Bank banker opponent or chief opponent in that race, even though Aristide had 67% of that vote at the time they were counting, and it may have been higher. They stopped counting. Of course, Aristide told him, or not Aristide, but his people at least, told him where to go, and Aristide became president. But really since then, and we have to remind the listeners that it was 7 months later that the U.S. helped engineer a coup d'etat that ousted Aristide. Ever since then, every election has had some form of UN or OAS monitoring or involvement. And again, the most egregious example is that of 2011, where the head of Minusta, in fact, intervened and told two of the candidates, Mirlande Maniga and Michel Martelly, who had both said they were not going to accept the first round along with the other candidates, and told them, no, no, the fix is in. You're going to be one of the runoff participants. And so both of them were sort of given the nod or the tap, and they went in under Minusta's and Washington's and the OAS's aegis. So I think this is very likely to play out again. And the other thing we should raise, Glenn, is the role of electronic voting machines, which even in this country are highly controversial. Their software is supposedly proprietary and a secret how they arrive at their results. And the results we've seen are often far different from what the exit polls would suggest they should be. And so if they end up using voting machines as the Martelly-Lamotte government was planning, it may well be that the fix is put in through that mechanism. But in any case, for sure, there are too many opportunities and chances and likelihoods of mischief and malfeasance if either Martelly or Minusta are allowed to run those elections.
And you were talking about the Dessalinian opposition. Could you explain who that is and where they are positioned in the political arrangement of forces?
Yes, well, the opposition, we can essentially say, has three principal currents, the first being the Lavalas family, who by its own admission is the moderate opposition. Then there is the patriotic movement of the democratic opposition, and they've since changed their name to Dessalinian, I think, to get with the program. That is, they changed the democratic to Dessalinian, so MOPOD, which is essentially the political class, traditional politicians. Many of them supported the 2004 and 1991 coups, and they are the second current. And then the third is the Dessalinian current, which essentially has two currents within it. One is the Dessalin Coordination, or COD, K-O-D, which is a new party, which was formed in February. And essentially, they have been pushing the notion of no Martelly, no Minusta for quite a while, even before it was fashionable. And they are made up of, I could say, a hardcore of seasoned militants from many years of struggle in Haiti. And then there is the platform of the Dessalines children, Plateforme Petite Dessaline, which is similar to CORD politically, but I could say broader, a more disparate group of different organizations, some of them not too reliable, some of them have already jumped ship and gone over to Martelly and so forth. The Petite Dessaline current is headed by Moïse Jean-Charles, who is sort of a charismatic leader, we could say, of the movement generally, and particularly of the Dessalinian current. But the essence of that current is, as the Dessalinian moniker would suggest, to drive out the invaders. It's an anti-imperialist current. And the other two currents are maybe more likely to give in on that particular principle. But the Dessalinian current has insisted that these elections must be sovereign, that Minusta, the UN, must be not allowed to control, run, and oversee the elections.
And yet you said that even some trends within the Dessalinian movement have capitulated in some way to Martelly.
Right. Well, that has more to do, I would say, with sort of the organizational practice of particularly the Petite Dessaline coalition, which was trying to make it as broad as possible. And in fact, when it was being formed, Senator Moïse Jean-Charles, who was also a founding member of COD, came to COD and asked them to join in to it. But COD looked at a number of the people in and said, listen, this is way too broad. You've got a lot of very questionable people who have a history of turning their coat, and we're not too enthusiastic about entering into something with them. Like, could we have a little more discerning policy? And anyway, it went forward like that, and indeed they did turn their coats. So it politically, however, the Petite Dessaline continues to articulate a good message, which is that Martelly must go and Minusta must go, which is the same as COD's. So I would say it's more the organizing principle, maybe the difference between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks, shall we say.
And we see that Raul Castro, the leader of Cuba, mentioned Haiti prominently in his address to CELAC, the Latin American International Organization.
Yes, of course, the Cubans, as Haiti's Western neighbor, have a very great interest in what is happening in Haiti and have provided, since 1995, a corps of doctors who Haitians really regard as deities because of the incredible medical services they provide the country in the deep countryside under very difficult conditions. And thousands of Cuban doctors have gone through Haiti in the past 20 years. So Cuba has really played a truly internationalist role, as it has in so many other parts of the world, but particularly in Haiti, in showing really disinterested, no strings attached solidarity and aid for the people. So, yes, it was gratifying to see Raoul give such importance to Haiti.
That was Kim Ives of Haiti Liberté in Brooklyn, New York.
South Africa's largest union, the National Union of Metal Workers, or NUMSA, is forging ahead with its campaign to form a genuinely socialist political party to challenge the pro-capitalist policies of the ruling African National Congress, the ANC. The ANC government effectively controls the National Labor Confederation, COSATU, which expelled the Metal Workers Union from its ranks last year. NUMSA leader Irvin Jim visited the United States recently. Paul Jay of the Real News Network asked Irvin Jim how the metal workers got on a collision course with South Africa's ruling party 2 years ago.
In the 9th Congress of NUMSA, workers gave us a very tight mandate. They told us that you have been champions of mobilizing us to vote for the ANC. The ANC must implement the Freedom Charter. The ANC must champion manufacturing and industrialization. The ANC must break with GEA, which is growth, employment, and redistribution strategy, which has failed, which continues to destroy jobs. So it must intervene in the economy and champion manufacturing and industrialization. It must address issues of ownership and control. It means it must take ownership of our strategic minerals with a view to defend the current existing capacity, but also to use those minerals to build new industries and diversify. This is not to say that those who continue to benefit out of extraction of our minerals must not be able to benefit, but workers took a very firm view that we must be the first people who actually must benefit out of the jobs that must be created at the back of the minerals that the country is having. The reality is that the ANC was not prepared to do that. We pushed it, and it was clear right from the dismissal of the ANC Youth League, which basically was clear that it demanded nothing else except to demand that they must fully implement the Freedom Charter. NUMSA as well, we championed that we need a full implementation of the Freedom Charter.
The Freedom Charter essentially means the nationalization of natural resources.
Well, that's key, including that the people shall govern, including that education must be at the center of everything else we do, including to deal with the question of the fact that there was the Land Act of 1913, where 87% of the land is still in the hands of a tiny white minority. And in 2004, we were basically promised through the contract with the people which the ANC committed itself, that it would have poverty, it will have unemployment, it will do away with the bucket system. In other words, people would have proper infrastructure in relation to sanitation. And 30% of the land would have been returned back to its rightful owners. I can tell you that less than 10% of the land has been returned, meaning that 87% of the land is still in the hands of a tiny white minority. Even the land that has been returned is completely unproductive. Nothing has been done in line with the Freedom Charter that called for a state that provides seeds and tractors. In other words, that ensure that the people can be able to till the land and be able to be productive.
Now, ANC had turned their back on the Freedom Charter right from 94. When the ANC becomes the government, they do not adopt the Freedom Charter as their program. What brought this to the head in 2013?
What is very strange, which basically led us to the decision that we took, is that in all elections, when they campaign on the basis, they win all elections, they convince workers by saying, look, we'll implement the Freedom Charter, which is one issue which led us to the Special National Congress in 2013. And on all the aspiration that workers felt that, you know, the Freedom Charter is not a socialist document itself.
But it's pretty close.
It's not really.
Public ownership of natural resources?
No, not really. Honestly, I think it is a breakthrough that would have made sure that both black and white in South Africa have got equal access to the economy, and such that the noble objective from which we would all have built from and deal with racism and everything else. But also what is very strange is the fact that the ANC itself, in its own theory, it regards the working class, both working in the factories, unorganized, as a motive force of the revolution. And what we rejected is that in every election, indeed, because the working class is numerical in numbers, will return the ANC into power. But when it comes to policies that it promises this working class, it takes a right-wing turn. And we ended up in a special national congress at a time. The ANC was privatizing roads. It was bringing back privatization through the new NDP. So the reality, we needed to go and reflect and say to workers, give us a mandate, what did we do? And indeed, we did a very critical analysis in the state of the organization. Workers took resolution. And they were watershed resolution in the interests of workers, in the interests of the revolution, in the interests of South African working class. And workers resolved that, one, we shall not campaign for the ANC, which would have killed workers in Marikana in a massacre different to others who spoke a lot of English without science, who suggested that, look, this was not a massacre. It was every definition that people tried. They look for English. We were there. We know what happened in Bisho, in Kwalanga, where massacres took place.
Just very quickly, Marikana was a place where there was a miner strike.
In Marikana, it was the worst disaster where a democratical government openly massacred and killed 34 workers, which basically set a precedent and basically exposing the fact that it's a precedent which could be repeated.
You're in the leadership. You can be a target. Do you think about these things?
Well, history shall not forgive any huge movement for its wrong perception of reality. I think that society is divided between two classes, the working class and the capitalist class. I think for those who must champion the interests of the working class, you got a choice. It's a conscious decision that you take, whether you are going to serve the interests of the working class. And I think I am one of those who would be counted, who have taken side. Look, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be a rocky road. Already we ended the year with a planted story that I'm part of the people who are mobilizing to overthrow government. And there is growing intolerance. Democracy is being undermined. If you speak your mind, you're working with imperialist forces, working with CIA, we're working with foreign agencies. But we think that we're very clear. We're championing the interests of the working class. Yes, there is a risk of being killed, but we can't be preoccupied by it.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.
United We Fight, the African Internationalist Conference on African Women, is being sponsored by the African People's Socialist Party.
March 21st and 22nd at the Stewart Center, 821 Vernon Street, Northeast in Washington, D.C.
Get involved and register now for issues African women face. Political and social oppression, economic exploitation,
underemployment, social immobility.
End to the political and social oppression, bringing African women into political life.
Register now at www.apspuhuru.org/AI Women's Conference
or call 202-642-4672. That is 202-642-4672.
For the Conference on African Women, Saturday and Sunday, March 21st and 22nd in Washington, D.C. www.apspuhuru.org/AI Women's Conference.
It's now time to order Omali Ishitela's new book, The Uneasy Equilibrium, The African Revolution versus Parasitic Capitalism. Chairman Omali's groundbreaking political analysis shows the way forward for people looking for answers during this period of crisis for imperialism, a crisis that offers great opportunity for colonized peoples everywhere. This latest book by the founder and leader of the African Socialist International and the Uhuru Movement costs $29.99. Order now at burningspearmarketplace.com or by calling 727-824-5700. Call 727-824-5700 or visit burningspearmarketplace.com today. Uhuru means freedom.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.